Today is Saturday, November 2nd, 2019. This is a part 9 Grand Canyon oral history interview with Dixon Dick Hingson, H-I-N-G-S-O-N. My name is Tom Martin. This recording is being conducted at the dining room table at our house in Flagstaff. Good morning, Dick. How are you?
Oh, I'm doing great. Great. Glad to be here.
In our last interview, part 8, we had talked about the Garland decision, which allowed the FAA to implement a final rule based on 1998 decision. And that final rule came out in 2000. And it didn't settle the high-flying jets issue. And it didn't settle the peak day issue, like how much was too much on any one day. And meanwhile, you took up a job working for the Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance, and your sister had a timeshare there just outside of Zion National Park.
Right at the edge of what was now the new Escalante National Monument.
Okay.
Clinton.
So pick the story up.
Yeah. All right. Well, that's right. It, first of all, right there at the tail end, right in that period, it should be just remembered that the decision of the D.C. Appeals Court was then appealed by the D.C. lawyers and Hogan Lovells to the U.S. Supreme Court. And I was enlisted in that effort because, of course, that meant a whole schedule of briefings, submissions to the court. But the end of it came when the court declined to hear the case. The Supreme Court of the United States declined to hear the case.
And this is the Garland decision. Was appealed.
The Garland court decision was appealed, mm-hmm. and it was
okay.
Not carried further because the court wouldn't take it,
wouldn't hear it,
as they usually don't.
So what did that leave you with?
Well, it left us with the implications were that, 50% would be considered, half of the canyon arguably impaired, half of the canyon moderately restored, and it would be the game going forward unless something else was done, and that would be on average day. And average day is not as nearly as tour busy as is peak day. And we still did not have a finished rules on all of this, so that also left us with all kind of issues about decisions that the Park Service had made about noticeability versus audibility as a technical matter in scoring all this before we got to the end game. And, all right, we can talk about noticeability and audibility because that was a handicap given to the FAA in a certain way. At least that's how we felt about it. And the meaning of it was that the canyon zones, as per the Park Service zones, would be the basis for a new dual division in which most of the park recommended for wilderness would be subject to an audibility base as the threshold at which the noise began to count. However, there were zones which could arguably develop zones, which at least on paper gave some basis for an attempt to work another compromise with the FAA. The argument, of course, being that, well, people out there on Mather Point couldn't possibly be concerned about airplanes anyway. There's all this other noise and so forth from visitors and buses and train and cars and so forth. So they, the Park Service made a compromise, which I understand was controversial even within, that they would have this, they would add 10 decibels to the floor, to the audibility floor, after which the flights would begin to count. And that, of course, that it led to ridiculous things. One of the most, when you looked at the map, you saw it was ridiculous. You had areas in the South Rim developed zone which were far enough removed from any highway or any interference from people that they should have been left with the audibility standard. And on the same on the North Rim, where you had areas up there, for example, at many hours of the day where you had no motor noise, you had no interference, and could have been left just as well in the audibility. So you have this tiny, then you get these tiny acreages, especially the North Rim, which just looked ridiculous
right.
in terms of the large picture of the Grand Canyon.
Dick, you mentioned that even within the National Park Service itself, there were people that thought the audibility standard should not be compromised into a noticeability standard. Do you have any idea who was on either side of that argument?
Not much, except a hunch. I have a hunch that Wes Henry probably offered up that compromise just based on, you know, reading between the lines. We would have to research through maybe FOIA, you know, probably should be done, how that was reached. But I think it was somewhere at that level in the Washington office.
Yeah, no, the reason why I was asking was he's passed away, and I was just trying to think of who would be interesting to interview on both sides of that discussion to tease out what the arguments were.
Fair enough. So. Many of those who were, there were more than one had passed away. Mm. Oh, sure. We had the people who were there then are there not there now. Mm. I suspect that the coordinator, the acoustics coordinator that came in, Ken McMullen, would be one person that would have insight into this. And there was another who I did work with around the year 2000 a fair bit, and the name may pop up as we go along. You know, I did have some good, he took over the noise analysis at Grand Canyon right around 2000 and was in place for, I can't think of the name this minute, but he would have known where some of the bodies were buried, and pretty clearly did, because he was supportive of everything I was trying to do to move the ball. We had a deadline also in there, which was implicit in that we need to talk about right at that, about that point. And the deadline is referenced to the Clinton executive order, which one, if you reread the executive order, it had two deadlines. It had not only the 8-year deadline about when the substantial restoration was to be accomplished, but there was also to be a intermediate step called a comprehensive noise management plan for the park, which was to be in place at the 5-year mark, counting from April 22 of 1996, that being the date of the executive order. So on that date, we would have gotten a comprehensive noise management plan, which of course would have allowed the Park Service leeway to take up a number of matters about the overflight's noise, and maybe other, and maybe in conjunction with other noise, nothing to stop it, and then maybe have an adaptive management plan triggered in there or set up that would carry them beyond 2008. That all makes sense in terms of the scope of what that was supposed to be, and that was directed by the president.
That comprehensive noise plan had a 5-year timeline to be put in place. When did that 5 years expire?
Well, the 5 years,
was that 2000?
By our calculations, then would have been April 22, 2001.
2001, thank you. Okay.
But it never appeared.
Okay. Why?
Blocked.
By?
bureaucratic delay and stalling fights inside and outside Park Service. Probably that's just my speculation.
Between the NPS and the FAA?
Oh, anything like that would be a major bone of contention with the FAA, which whose history is not to move on anything unless forced.
Okay.
And by that time, who was president? Bush.
Okay.
So you lose. You didn't have Clinton or any successor to him to mind the store.
Okay.
You have a hostile Secretary of the Interior again, Gail Norton. Failure on all fronts, driven from office finally and replaced after a failed attempt to change the management policies of the Park Service.
Okay. And so
I think Tom Hale is the name of the NPS person. Tom Hale.
H-A-L-E,
and I have many emails from him.
And what was his role?
I think he was sort of the staff overflights coordinator for the Park Service or for the region at that time. I can't remember exactly. I did meet with him. We also had Ken Weber on board through those years, who would also know where all these things went to.
Mm-hmm.
Ken Weber, he now lives in Pueblo, Colorado.
Okay, so moving this timeline along, April 2001 comes and goes. There is no comprehensive noise plan, no adaptive management plan. And
the Supreme Court had rejected further appeals up that way. So you get a rule out. They got a rule out. Finally, you have a final rule that sets the path forward for the next several years on what's to be done. And then, of course, the quiet technology is still an outstanding issue. So, because that was part of the whole original administrative scheme, was that Senator McCain always had this idea that quiet technology would move the ball forward to ensure that they accomplish the SRNQ threshold. So we had another, there were still these two outstanding issues. One had to do with what the quiet technology rule would look like, and then there was the elephant in the bedroom, which was the overhead jets and the noise of the jets. So obviously there's still whole lots of room for and average day versus peak day unsettled. I mean, those are the matters still going forward as we entered the 2001 time frame, and no comprehensive noise management plan, which of course should have settled all those things. That's okay. What it was for. Or would have been for. So you've got agency delinquencies and subterfuge all over the place, and you'd have nothing.
Do you think that the National Park Service had actually pulled together a plan that was never released to the public?
I don't know how far they got with it. I think they were, I'm pretty sure Hale was working on some internal document, and he was trying to push it, because I met with him and had interviews. He gave me all kinds of things, but not very specific about that. And so we still had these, we had a number of these. Even the dual zone was still in their arguments going on about that at that point. So we had a nest of issues, about four of them, that were still bubbling all over the place as I started the work at Zion, and they were provided me a basis to keep linked to that work, therefore, because it was not settled. I did it for, and of course I was beginning to make contacts with the Utah chapter of the Sierra Club, which arguably should have been equally concerned with the Grand Canyon chapter, because the whole North Rim is basically their rim. It's far more accessible to their people than to the South, than to California. But so I began to meet people in the Utah chapter, as part of this. In fact, I have one very, I think I'll just say it for the history, just to, so it's in this record. One of these first places where I met those Utah people was that in 1999, end of 99, late 99, in fact, it was August, would have been in August of 1999, I was scheduled to give testimony for, you know, for the Sierra Club at an FAA hearing in Salt Lake City. And the personal side note to this, but it's powerful, is that I was en route to deliver that testimony, riding an Amtrak overnight sleeper train. This is what happens to activists trying to do the activist thing. You're riding the overnight sleeper train on Amtrak from a friend and a supportive friend on this in Tahoe area. I boarded the train at Tahoe City, or Lake Tahoe North side, and falling asleep in the sleeper car of the coach, very comfortable, unaware of anything or anything going wrong. And out of the blackness of the night was suddenly there was a looming shape there beside me, and I was bludgeoned by a young male assailant with two beer bottles, which he'd gotten on the train. And led to a wound requiring emergency transport back to Elko, stopped the train, whole train, full of passengers for an hour. I first made a citizen's arrest on the assailant because they brought him to me at the back of the ambulance, one of the most dramatic incidents of my life, actually. And yes, that was him. I knew, couldn't, saw enough of him. And they had him, they had pushed him down the stairs into the well of the passenger car and held him until we could make a citizen's arrest from the back of the ambulance. So he was transported to the Elko County Jail, and I was transported to the hospital for 25 stitches. And I did not attend the court arraignment because I was scheduled to appear 3 days later in an FAA hearing in Salt Lake City. So I made the choice to go on, even though still recovering. Meanwhile, as a side note, he failed to show. And of course, therefore, the a warrant issued for his arrest. He fled the state. And there's a whole side story on what became of him and the failure of the Nevada authorities to capture him. And the failure was that they set the bail at only $600.
Ooh.
For something that in Utah would have been a much higher level assault, any state but Nevada. But you're dealing with the Wild West culture, barroom brawls, that kind of mentality. And so Nevada's lax, and he got away. He tried to board the train again. In fact, 3 days later, I was told by and they had the same conductor on the train, who said, you looked at him and said, you're not getting on this train. And you would think they could have apprehended him at that point. But they weren't organized to do that. And so I could go on to what happened about that failed arrest.
What happened to him?
Because that has consequences in the legal system and in the lives of other people, this administrative failure.
Exactly.
The administrative failure meant that, you see, his parents were able to post him the $600 bail.
Okay.
That's all that was required to get out to escape. He was lucky because I didn't, otherwise would have shown up at his arraignment, and what didn't. And so he's gotten money now to go back to home, which turned out to be Colorado, Western Colorado and Telluride. And I stayed with that case, and it actually consumed a fair bit of my time through the 2000s because I thought no justice had been done. And in fact, I was right, because It turned out that somewhere in the middle 2000s, on a routine yearly call to the Elko County District Attorney's Office, she notified me, the clerk notified me, a letter had come in from the defendant's mother. Now, they owed me restitution of $2,000 or so dollars for the medical expenses. That was on the record. And so if he came back, we would be dealing with that. But what had happened meanwhile, and more like just in the year before she made that contact with that office, he had, in a city park in Montrose, Colorado, randomly gone after a married Hispanic couple walking in the park on a pleasant summer evening. And he stabbed the husband and was chasing after the wife, but somehow with the help of bystanders or something, they apprehended him. And so he was then brought to justice, but first, because he was deemed mentally unfit to stand trial, was incarcerated, or first incarcerated, but then put on enough mental psychiatric drug treatment to restore him to a level at which he could stand trial.
Mm-hmm.
And that took some months. And of course, when he did stand trial, he was found guilty, but the time spent in the mental hospital, you know, schizophrenia, time spent in the mental hospital was credited to time served, and then there was some other time served in the jail, and then he was let go. And the record that I've obtained subsequently is that there was a whole parade then of minor to moderate offenses, threatening behavior, threats against people, trespassing, all kinds of just out of control. We also uncovered that he had broken a warrant in California, a probation term from a drug arrest in California, to even been in Nevada to attack me. So that had been, you know, from the years earlier. So it goes to show the weaknesses of the, you know, and problems of the criminal justice system in three Western states right there.
And where is he today?
I don't have any record, Pat. I just checked in the last week for any evidence of a record, and it's the record for Colorado appears to have stopped in 2013, although I found new evidence he had gotten back into California. If they'd found him there, he could have been rearrested. But he was busted for a broken headlight on a bike, and then fled, a failure to appear. And a warrant is out, therefore, in California and in Nevada. And Colorado, he's obviously on watch.
Okay.
That's what I know today.
Okay.
So it's an interesting side. You know, this is life.
No, it's just what it is. So you were headed
To make a talk, to speak to the...
testimony.
I had this very, you know, elaborate testimony that I gave at the hearing.
Showed up with your head in a big bandage?
Well, there was something on the face there. I can't remember exactly what. Mm-hmm. Maybe it had come off by then. There had to be a bandage. And a black eye. I mean, mm-hmm. It was a black eye with all the healing fast. Mm-hmm. It was getting hard. But I remember that I never forget the FAA representative studying who I was. Because I gave my talk with the usual force and power that I would give any talk on this subject, and they had to listen to it.
Okay.
So we could get her name. We could get the record if that was important, you know, because that's an August hearing, late August hearing of 1999 in Salt Lake City. But then...
What were your main points at the hearing? Do you remember them?
Oh, that would...
One or two?
See, what would the... We'd have to look at what that hearing stated subject was.
Okay.
It was probably on the dual zone... the dual zone would have been up for review at that point. and
the
maybe the quantum
noticeability
technology, audibility, noticeability, and perhaps the quark technology, but this will have to be matched on the record. And
okay,
I don't
no
have
worries.
To say
no.
That,
I was just asking.
To it.
Yeah.
So then I'm back in. We're in 2000 in Utah, and when I'm in Utah, I got some interesting pair of assignments. One was volunteer and one was paid, that kept the roof over my head and interest going. One was that the Utah Wilderness Act was being proposed and still surveyed by, under the direction of Jim Kaplan of the National Sierra Club. And I think he's been a board member, if I'm not mistaken. And I was assigned to an area near Hilldale and Laverkan, to do a boundary survey, you know, where they proposed to draw the wilderness line. This is under a standard survey protocol. And as part of that work, I discovered a gorgeous, stunning alcove just inside the wilderness boundary and just west of Hilldale, where there were gorgeous petroglyphs and a tribal winter solstice apparition site, where a sun phenomenon coming through an opening in the rock appeared as a flaming torch on the back wall, rising and through the sunset.
Nice.
Beautiful thing. Mm. Later vandalized.
Mm.
But I documented it into pictures and got the BLM involved with it at the local BLM office.
Mm.
And then I got a job working as a census year. So I had finished up the Zion. I did the Zion summer, you know, and on leaving, I had Zion. What next? I mean,
I've got a question for you about the 2000 census. Some of the census employees, temporary and Flagstaff, took the census of Colorado City and found some interesting things there. Did you find any interesting things while you were working for the census as far as families and, or it was just normal?
I would say working for the census didn't bring up any remarkable surprises, except that they did assign me for a couple of days of census tract work in Hilldale.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So I was there.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And I got in touch with, in fact, therefore, the geography around there, and I learned where Colorado City was.
Okay.
And as long as I've mentioned, I should say I got involved with a proposal to build an airport at Colorado City. So that was one of my ways that I continued my expertise in dealing with the FAA. And basically, the things that I did led to us winning that fight.
Hmm.
The FAA saw that they were trying to do a runaround and blocked the proposed airport at Colorado City.
Okay.
So that was one exciting thing. But the question was, after I left the tabling in Zion, of course, which has many stories about natural quiet and listening and at night and pictures and all kinds of things, after leaving that work, the question is, what next? And I almost just came close to what might have been a big mistake in just leaving the area without a plan and heading on towards Colorado. However, en route, I think I had my first cell phone at that point. I got a call from the U.S. Census Bureau based in St. George, and they were offering me a job as a census enumerator. And could I be at a training session of 3 days in Hurricane, Utah? And, well, I turned around right then, and I stopped, very happy about that. Went to a Suwa wilderness gathering en route, which had been planned. had a 3-day grand adventure with the Red Rock Wilderness that they were trying to protect, and then started census tract work. I had a blazer, which meant that I could do that.
I'm going to just jump in here, and SUWA is S-U-W-A, and stands for
Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance.
Thank you.
Dave Pacheco was my supervisor.
Okay.
P-A-C-H-E-C-O. And so then began a stretch of paid work with the blazer, and they gave me the most remote places because I had the blazer.
Okay.
So I got remarkable assignments. One included interviewing the superintendent of Zion National Park in his own home, Don Falvey. And Falvey had been my...
How do you spell his last name?
F-A-L-V-E-Y.
Thank you.
And I had met him during the West Henry 1994 noise monitoring.
Okay.
So he knew me.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't long before, this is somewhere during the census years, and that another controversy was blowing up. And I got a call from, I think it was Jeff Bradybaugh, who is now the superintendent of Zion. And Jeff knew about my work, of course, with being head of the resource management division at Zion. And so what they had got wind of, well, they'd known it for some years, but they knew it was coming to push, was coming to shove on building the St. George replacement airport, which would be much bigger airport than the little thing they had up on a mesa in downtown St. George. So we had looming another fight between the FAA and the Park Service over NEPA. And they could use my experience with that. And so we had a big public hearing at which I spoke for the Sierra Club. I still remember the comment that I heard about from one of the opposition side there, that one of the airport, they called that the speaker from hell, and that was me. So, well, it served notice this wasn't going to be easy.
Right.
They didn't want to hear that. Mm. Boosterism.
This was a public hearing put forward by the FAA or the National Park Service?
FAA.
Okay.
There's the Park Service sitting in the front row.
Okay.
Never forgot them sitting there silently.
You bet.
Taking in everything.
Okay.
And so we had the beginning of a fight over the St. George replacement airport and the whole NEPA process and an EIS, which was going to take a couple of years, or maybe only a year, before it would be back in the D.C. Court of Appeals.
Okay.
Just like Grand Canyon 1 and Grand Canyon 2. Because the FAA and the Park Service is just another example. The FAA resents the Park Service getting into NEPA and interfering with their NEPA standard setting.
Remind me again about what Grand Canyon 1 and Grand Canyon 2 stand for. I know you've probably talked about
Grand
it earlier.
Grand Canyon 1 is the substantial restoration of natural pod definition and also fighting off various challenges from the air crew operators.
Okay.
Grand Canyon 2 is about, that's coming, and that's going to be over the issues, I mean, it's building that didn't get hurt in 02, or maybe we'll have to look what date, but I was at that hearing. I think it was maybe 01, 02. We can look when, but the hearing was going to, Grand Canyon 2 was about the dual zone. It was about the peak day and the jets. So the jets were very much a part of the concern here, and that's a concern at Zion, as I had learned from my sound monitoring, because in the high altitude country where you have no other baseline noise, the jets are the 99% of any potential noise disruption from mechanized motors. So it's a heavy issue, and it's on the table. And the implications of Zion are quite striking, because over Zion, Zion's under a trunk airline route, coast to coast, Chicago to LA, Chicago to Las Vegas, Denver to Las Vegas, Denver to LA.
And there's a choke point, isn't it? There's a restricted military areas that choke these jets, cross-country jets, right over Zion or nearby?
Well, they tend to choke them, The big area is actually in southwestern Nevada and northeastern California, or southeastern California. Southwestern California, just east of Death Valley National Park, is a huge restricted area that they have to fly around. So this squeezes what is already a heavily dense trunk airline route even more, and forces the planes over Zion and Grand Canyon and the acres in between.
Dick, I've got a question for you. Which do you think came first, as aviation began going, certainly in the 50s, the big airlines wanted to fly over the canyon to see it, so their passengers could see it. But I assume by then, the big military bases were already in place. Is that right? I mean, I'm going way back in time now, into the 30s and 40s and 50s. Just thinking about China Lake and you know the 30s. Nevada test site, these big military areas came up while this cross country flying was in its infancy, I should say.
It's true. So you had a coincidence. That's okay, right. They coincided, and the first military training flights, for example, over Death Valley. As early as the mid-30s.
Okay.
So they were building that empire, too. Military, DOD was part of this mix every bit, and I was still involved with issues with the military routes, even from, and the first 10 years of the 2000s.
From your Joshua Tree.
From the Joshua Tree.
Uh-huh.
So we still had the Park Service preoccupied with that.
Mm. Okay.
All through this time, so you... All of this stuff had come bust out together, you know, high and low and military.
Right, right.
So military, all this, of course, would have to be modeled into NEPA.
Okay.
You know, if you're doing any kind of, if you're doing NEPA the way it's supposed to be done, which was a big headache for the FAA, of course, all of it, noise. So anyway, for Zion, I mean, we can go back to what happened with Joshua Tree at the right time, but it didn't get settled on, let me see, we didn't settle that. Well, we settled that right around 2000. We could look at that record. That was formalized about the time I left the Sierra Club.
That's Joshua Tree?
Joshua Tree. And I will say what helped enable it to be settled. And for the record, that we should note that the California Desert Protection Act, whose anniversary was this weekend, it was the 25th anniversary, was Halloween 2 days ago, enlarged the southern part of Joshua Tree National Park substantially, along with a large addition to Death Valley. And by enlarging that southern strip of Joshua Tree National Park, provided a bonanza option to reroute the jets away from the picnic areas and the campgrounds in the visitor center where they'd been flying, to a route paralleling the southern border of Joshua Tree National Park. They couldn't do that without NEPA and public hearing, because of the communities that had grown up close to the southern border of Joshua Tree. So I was involved with that until we completed that work in 2000 sometime. That was signed off on. But it was a success story in the end for that park, which was written up by the Park Service and the FAA as an example of success story.
Okay.
However, you still have the ramifications of the concentration of caused by the military restricted areas, which are then going to force the commercial flights over Zion. And I'd learned from the sound monitoring I did in 94 that when you're up in the high country of Zion, rocky country terrain, with decibel levels going down to 10 in the mornings,
the ambient background noise,
that's the natural ambient, is 10 decibels or 15 or 20. But those jets are peaking at 40, one after another, all day long. So what does that mean? That just means constant motorized intrusions over prime Zion wilderness backcountry. It wasn't wilderness yet. That was made wilderness by law about 10 years later.
Mm-hmm.
That hasn't changed the jets, though.
Mm, right.
But there. So the one thing that did change was that in 95. Well, we were in a phase out. We were phasing out stage two jets. So they're the noisier ones, and I believe that by the 2000 you had to be in stage three, which is the quieter in quotes, so that you don't have quite the high LMAXs that you would have got from the stage two jets. So that's a move forward, to which would help modestly, but measurably.
And what does L2 stand for?
Well, what I was referring to was zoning of the engine technology of the, it. What did I say it was? It stands for engine specifications for quietness.
Okay, thank you.
FAA has a scheme of 1, 2, 3, and 4, and they're phasing in 4 along some kind of timeline now, I think.
Okay.
But then we were phasing in 3.
Okay.
So that's, you have all this complication going on. And of course, all these changes create all kinds of things. So
it's interesting because I think about McCain saying, well, we want to go to quiet technology, which for low flying tour flights was a disaster. But for the high flying jets, maybe it actually was a little
better. It was more honestly based metric because it's based on the source noise.
Okay. But so I'm thinking, all right, as we have a quieter engine, we can allow more flights, which is what FAA is all about, more
That's
flights.
That's right.
So there's a, it's like...
Well, there's still going to be a push-pull about that.
Okay.
Because obviously they were headed for more flights.
Right. I mean,
the expansion of the national airspace system was just continued unabated.
Sure.
Through all those years.
Sure.
But you're going to do it with planes that are certified quieter at the source, never mind how many passengers.
Okay.
But you get to this problem with the low level, and the definition they worked out for the... said it was going to solve the Grand Canyon problem, they went to this seat efficiency ratio, which does not have to do with the absolute noise power of that given engine.
So
it's a ratio based on number of passengers against the engine.
This is an interesting question of metrics. What metric are we going to use?
That's correct.
To measure this by, and there are some crazy metrics all across all kinds of agencies, many of which benefit commercial interest.
Right.
And so I would assume that a metric that one might want for any aircraft is actual noise levels, not based on the number of passengers.
That's correct.
So how did that metric of hey, if it makes more noise, but it carries more passengers, it's quieter. How did that get in as a metric? Do you remember?
Nobody really knows in terms of if you want names to bodies. But I suspect we think that we have to identify who was the lead on all this for the FAA. That was Carl Burleson. So I would follow tracks towards Carl Burleson's desk. He's still their international affairs coordinator.
Okay.
Very resistant to the our Park Service intrusion of their metrics. Would not work with the Park Service on NEPA. So he got around it that way with the, and I believe it's probably Burleson, though I can't prove that. We don't know these things without FOIA. But probably Burleson. I sat at a table with Burleson once at an Acoustic Society presentation, and I criticized what he was doing.
How do you spell his name?
B-U-R-L-E-S-O-N. Carl Burleson.
C-A-R-L?
C-A-R-L. Oh, okay. Yes, his involvement in this should be definitely ripe for historians to investigate.
Okay.
And so we had this issue, and we objected to it, but the record can be checked for exactly when the quiet technology rule became official, but it was in the early 2000s.
Okay.
But it didn't stop us from taking two things into court, because we still have the question of whether the jet noise wasn't supposed to be counted anyway.
Okay. You know?
And the jet noise was so loud as to cover, to bring 99% of the park into non-compliance with the Overflights Act. 99% non-compliant, no matter what they did. And so the Park Service, in those early, it shows in the record we just have online there, but they finally prevailed with enough power to get the jet noise taken out of the Overflights Act as something that would be used to measure substantial restoration by. Well, I don't have more to say except that they did it.
So I'm confused. Wait a minute.
Congress passed that. Congress passed that.
So Congress passed a law that said you will not count the jet.
That's right. First it was administrative. Okay. But we have to look at the chronology of when. It was first an administrative change which Congress ratified. And once Congress ratified, then it's done. This is all through the Bush years.
Okay. And who was pushing that in Congress, do you know?
McCain.
Okay.
And Don Young of Alaska.
Oh, okay.
Young. He wrote letters. They got letters out of him. And McCain that basically said Congress never really contemplated the jets.
Okay.
That's not true. It was very much a part of the record. But they found ways to tweak the import of the intent of Congress after several tries. Finally, they got the jets removed. Well, of course, if they didn't, they never would have matched they never would have got to the SRNQ required level. They couldn't have.
Okay. And it's interesting because in the historic record back in the 1950s, the park recognized both low-level and transcontinental aircraft
that's
causing noise.
Yes, they did. They did. Mm. And, you had even the case of the sightseeing disaster in 1956 was alleged more than once, and in many places actually, in the reportage that the two planes collided because they were off course trying to show off the canyon.
Right.
And that led to the establishment of the FAA over the Grand Canyon.
Right. Okay, so it's 2001. And I'm looking at the substantial restoration of natural quiet. There were hearings going on for Zion.
Yeah, St. George Replacement Airport. So you had that, and George. Then an EIS. Well, they started with an EA.
Okay.
So we should say a little more then. About
this was St. George Airport started with an EA.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's hot while I'm there. That starting with an EA, which was inadequate, we knew it was. So we Earth Justice got into it, and their attorney was Robin Cooley.
Okay.
And this is with the support from the Grand Canyon Trust. The Grand Canyon Trust was, they had an office in St. George.
Okay.
With whom I worked.
Okay.
And they understood what was at stake because I made sure they did. And they were basically supportive of all the work that we went to criticize this inadequate EA.
Mm-hmm.
So they come out, you have to wait though till they come out with the inadequate final EA and a record of decision. And then at that point, we had to see whether we could find an attorney. And we found Robin Cooley of Earth Justice, based in Denver.
Cooley?
C-O-O-L-E-Y. Robin Cooley.
Okay.
Young woman, fairly early in her legal career.
Okay.
And so she worked with me and her other means to work us through, help us work through the hearings and development following the record of decision of the EA with the appeal to the DC appeals court. Everything with the FAA has to go up into that Washington court, Ms. Merrick Garland's court now. And so we got to a developed brief on this about the failure of the FAA to do proper cumulative impacts analysis from all kinds of aviation types and so forth, and they just wanted to do part of it, you know, and ignore all the rest. So the question was, would the Grand Canyon Trust file a case or not? And the deadline was coming. And we came to the weekend before the deadline, and the trust still had not given the green light. While the discussions were going on, I knew, Robin told me, between them and her, about what to do. And Robinson? Robinson of the trust was deeply involved with that. And what he did, apparently, he actually was behind the scenes there, and actually without authorization by the usual Grand Canyon Trust Committee, went ahead and gave the lawyers in D.C., Robin Cooley and Earth Justice, permission to file the lawsuit. It was filed with moments to go. They had to hand carry the lawsuit through the streets of Washington at 11 o'clock at night on the final night with the deadline at midnight. And it was placed in the deposit box on the outside of the Court of Appeals just in time so it could be date stamped when they emptied the box at midnight. And the people that carried it to the Court of Appeals, the courier was Michael Kidney, our lead on the Grand Canyon case for all these years, Michael Kidney, K-I-D-N-E-Y.
Thank you.
He told me that on the phone. So I was thinking, that my life had been in vain, so to speak, when failure to file on such an obvious situation, but at the last minute, we got the reprieve that we needed, and Robin Cooley's case was filed by Earth Justice in the Court of Appeals, and that led to a hearing with that court some months later, as one would expect, because they took the case, and I was present for oral argument and saw it argued. And so the case was one of the two big cases that came down in the summer of 2002. One was Grand Canyon 2, and the other one was that one, the Zion case. Grand Canyon 2 and the Zion case were decided by the same court in the same summer.
Okay.
It's a big, and they were seen by us as victories.
Mm-hmm.
Because they threw the FAA for a loop, both of them. So it was a good sense of possibility in getting that much.
Okay. So the DC win then forced the FAA to go back and do an EIS.
At the cost of millions of dollars. For the St. George Airport. And they had to score not only the park, But all those wilderness areas around there, according to the latest sophisticated noise technology, far below the 65 decibel level they'd been hiding behind. They had to take it all the way down to a noise above 25, noise above 35, that kind of thing.
And what came out of that EIS?
The ultimate finding. After all the modeling was and the analysis of where the most likely air tracks with how many numbers and so forth, the airport would enable a certain amount of growth in numbers, that's true, but you also have the questions of where they were, like where are the likely flight routes and so forth, and it came out awash.
Okay.
That is, with no net increase or decrease in noise was the FAA's judgment, even though, Merrick Garland had warned them, though, that if it was any noise increase at all, that might be the straw that broke the proverbial camel's back, and they knew that.
So FAA would not push that. They'd come out and say then, well, there's going to be no net change.
They came out with an analysis that said no net change.
Okay.
After all of that.
Okay. Did they go ahead and impose route zones to keep flights away from Zion and wilderness areas then?
Well, it's hard to say exactly what was done, but the volume of traffic contemplated here, they may have, we'd have to look exactly at what's in that EIS and how the hell it modeled, but it's got to be related to the airport if it's going to count.
Uh-huh.
You can't do it just on the basis of, well, we're increasing overall traffic across the whole system. You know,
right.
Where are they actually likely to fly? And the FAA could pretty easily say that this was going to be going maybe south of the park when it went to Denver, or north when going to Salt Lake, and not over the Kolob section. And so you wound up. Maybe there'd be one or two flights, but it wasn't enough to, they were moving from stage two to three. You know, it wound up awash.
And Zion didn't have the overflights, the tour flights that Grand Canyon did.
Well, yeah, at that time, it wasn't at all clear what, because there was an IOA that had been granted for hundreds of flights over Zion.
What's an IOA?
Interim Operating Authority. The Interim Operating Authority, you see, this is the time where you had the new Air Tour Management Law coming into effect. It had been signed by President Clinton on April 5th of 2000. And so here I am, right? Where am I then? Starting my Zion years. So the first place I'm looking at is Zion, and what implications here? Well, of course, it took a while till they could even claim their IOA. You know, we didn't know what they were going to say. It was based on figures from 97, alleged figures from 97 and 98, and all of the interim operating authority that's still out there everywhere is based on figures from 25 years ago.
Okay.
And they were alleged and not audited. There was no auditing of your claim when you brought it in, like it's claiming a gold mine. You say, I got all this gold in this mine, and there's no audit.
Okay.
And so Zion operators claimed several, almost 1,000 flights. And Bryce, for example, claimed 3,500.
Wow.
And it was gross misrepresentation and fraud.
Okay.
Gross, in the light of the record. And in fact, there's been partial admission of it by the FAA that it allowed the fraud.
Okay.
On the record, they understand now that they just let the easy ride, the easy claim go through, and then once through, where do you get it out?
Right.
And that's the situation today.
Okay.
So we still have hundreds of flights over Zion, and of course I was looking for them all the time. I was in the park all the time, and you saw low-flying planes, and what is that? But we had no way, because there was no reporting. Congress didn't require reporting for 10 years. there was no reporting from the individual operator. They were not required to report the number of flights.
Okay.
So black box.
Right.
For a decade. And so fast forwarding to right now, it appears there are no tour flights over Zion, but that's because they've chosen to do their marketing elsewhere.
Like Grand Canyon?
Well,
or Grand
like
Canyon
around
West,
the
or?
Lake Mead area, and Grand Canyon West and Lake Mead. I mean, Alan Stevens is the main holder of IOA there, and he may have made a little bit of a strategic retreat there too, because he was making money by just moving them.
Okay.
So I think he's just hiding all his under another bush, and we're not dealing with air tours over the park. We're dealing with a new outfit around the park, but
okay.
Not over it.
Okay. And around the park would be Bureau of Land Management or U.S. Forest Service land?
Yeah, well, around it would have to do with other jurisdictions that don't care much.
Uh-huh.
That's
right.
You can see some stuff because it's only a half mile perimeter buffer that is required. You can see a lot of stuff around Zion.
Right.
That means, of course, you can fly over the Canaan Mountain Wilderness.
Uh-huh.
You can fly right over that, low as you want to, as often as you like.
Thinking about Grand Canyon then, with the loss of being able to include the high flyers, how did that impact you? I mean, and the others who were working on the issue, it would seem as though the rug was basically pulled out from under the fight, because those planes do make noise, and they make a lot of noise day
right.
and night.
Yes, it pulled an important rug out, no question of that. So now you're left with one last thing. Well, maybe two or three. I mean, there's still things. The main one, though, that we went after in Grand Canyon 2 lawsuit was peak day instead of average day.
Okay.
So peak day became the argument, and even then you saw the way the two agencies interplayed with each other. The Park Service squirreled their peak day argument into an obscure part, very obscure part of their recommendation or brief on the case or their report about it that led to the court decision, but the court found it. I mean, and of course our lawyers would point to anything that they could find.
Mm-hmm.
So even though it had been sort of sequestered off into a corner.
How do you mean? I'm not following.
Well, I'm just saying that the fact that the Park Service believed that peak day should be the standard
was
in the brief.
Okay.
It was in their brief and it was in their reportage, but they had, squirreled it into a corner there, maybe hoping not to have the FAA charge after them like a raging bull.
So this was under the Gail Norton administration?
Yeah, that's right.
Okay, so this goes back to politics.
That's right.
Impacting.
That's right.
On the ground.
That's right.
Management.
So what can you do under the radar?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's kind of like operating under the radar.
And so your team, the legal team brought together by Grand Canyon Trust
and
Sierra Club.
That's right. That team found that and used it effectively to win on peak day.
Okay, and that win on peak day said that the day of the year that has the loudest noise,
it will be the one that is scored for the purposes of determining whether substantial restoration of natural quiet has been achieved.
Versus the average day.
Versus the average day.
And an average day is much quieter.
That's correct.
And so was the concept, so I understand this, that the average day would be a better metric to use, because that would be where you'd want to hold the noise. Or am I missing how this...
Well, you want to get them at whatever the most sensitive point is. We could gore the ox a lot better with the peak day sword.
Can you explain that to me?
Well, that is...
I don't quite get
in
it.
Other words, if you you find on that the canyon is, say... Let's just say that you find that on April the 1st, the canyon is 58% restored under... the math, And then you find on August 8th, which is peak day, that it's not 58% restored, but it's only 39% restored, then you're out of compliance with the law for all of those days like that.
Okay,
all
so
of August, July days, you are out of compliance.
So the idea here is that anything above that 50% line
would be
out of compliance.
Out of compliance. Any 12-hour day is out of compliance. So you
okay.
can push them back. And then we thought they had more. We thought then we had lots of days like that. You know, the figures we'd been seeing suggested this was happening a whole lot.
Okay. And so, again, I'm still struggling with the... I'm not really bright here. The peak day versus the average day.
Yeah.
Okay, so the argument being an average day might be closer to the 50%. If you averaged around the year, especially in the winter when there were much greatly reduced flights,
that's right,
you would be under the 50%. So you could have a peak day way over where it's in the 30s.
Yeah, you could.
And that would be okay.
Well, yes, the implication is that you could have just the one day you had to take care of.
Well, you could have a number
of five days
that were over, but if in the winter you had a number of days we were under, that was okay because you would average it out over the year.
Yeah, it comes down to there. It's a every day, each and every day became the rule. Each and every day.
Okay, so in that point, if you
had
have
to be
a
compliant
50% limit, each and every day you can't go above that 50%.
That's correct.
Great, that makes sense. As just simply a metric. What's a metric you're going to have?
Yeah, it's easy enough to score.
Instead of saying, we're going to have some really loud days, and we're going to have some really quiet days, and that's going to get us to 50%.
No, they wouldn't compute it that way.
Did they try to do that?
Maybe we could have. There could have been arguments about that, and I'm not sure whether we did argue it or not, but it came down to...
No, you wouldn't want to. You would be out of compliance for a bunch of days and in compliance for a bunch, which is basically moving the goalposts. So it makes sense to say we have a 50%, we can't cross that.
Can't cross the 50%.
And how do we stay...
And you also need a buffer. And everybody agreed, Park Service and FAA understood you're going to need a buffer here because that's modeling.
Okay.
And that would be verified by other means. And then and there's still a margin of error even so. And so you would have to clear it.
Uh-huh.
You know, 52% is pretty dicey. If you're at 52 on any day, at 52 is questionable.
And
54.
When did this decision come out?
The peak day decision was handed down, I believe, in August of 2002 by the D.C. Court of Appeals.
And is that what you call Grand Canyon 2?
Grand Canyon 2.
Okay.
The Zion case was the same summer, so possibly I got the reverse. One came in May and one came in August. But anyway, I think it's August of 2002. We had that, but you see, we still didn't have enough comprehensive, really sophisticated noise modeling to know exactly where we were left at that point.
Hmm.
I mean, this was going to be it hadn't been done. And we're moving further into the 2000s, and so you've got a very unsettled situation even so, with the argument that there might be quite a lot of non-compliance. And... So this is setting the framework for McCain getting frustrated and saying, well, let's get this thing into alternative dispute resolution. You see, that's where obviously you've got McCain behind the scenes, and it's his institute. I mean, he founded this Tucson-based institute, and they had done some work, and it was a serious outfit. Yeah, that's, you know. So they were beginning to percolate that idea as a result of Grand Canyon 2 decision. Otherwise, you're going to have to do the rule, will have to come on, you'll have to complete the rulemaking through the NEPA-based formal public process.
Well, let's talk about this a little bit. The alternative dispute resolution would be to sort of take all the stakeholders and put them in a room and see if they could come up with something.
Right.
But you have NEPA.
That's what you'd call a voluntary plan in a way. Yes, that's right. It's a voluntary. Well, you would have to be. In fact, the ground rules for that turned out had to be unanimous. It would have to be a unanimous vote by that committee.
Okay.
Otherwise, no go.
Okay.
So everybody understood this was a tough road to hoe. What it was doing, though, was buying time in a way, too. And forcing technology. I mean, you're forcing a complicated bunch of stuff to go forward. You're going to force the technical.
But it bypasses the NEPA directive.
Yeah, well, it bypasses NEPA.
And that never sounds like a good idea.
And the Clinton deadline as well.
Okay.
The Clinton deadline, remember, of August 2208 is looming all the time. The court took the FAA at its word that it would be done in the park by April 2, 2008. So here's going to be then an excuse to carry on beyond April 22, 2008. Now you got that laid, the groundwork laid for delay.
Okay. Maybe now is a good time to wrap up this interview, because next interview we will talk about this alternative dispute resolution journey, how that worked or didn't work, and get to this, the 2006 and 2008 deadlines that came and went.
The deadlines were the 2002 obviously came and went.
Right. I'm sorry. I thought there was a...
There was a 2001 deadline. That's the five-year comprehensive noise plan.
Okay.
That's just an executive administrative deadline. It didn't have the force of Congress as Clinton's deadline. And Clinton's not in power anymore. And then you have the 2008 deadline, but they promised that to the court, that they would meet that one. They had a declaration to the court, we're going to meet the 2008 deadline.
Okay.
And that's still there at the point we stopped.
Okay. So does that make sense that now's a good time to...
Yes, I think we've laid the groundwork to look at the beginning of the ADR process, I think, and of course...
Now, what's ADR stand for?
Alternative Dispute Resolution.
Thank you.
And I think for both of us, just to look again at what I emailed you today, mm-hmm. will be very helpful with that, because the whole record is in there.
Yeah, good. Okay. With that, then, this will conclude part 9. Of a Grand Canyon oral history with Dick Hingson. Today is November 2nd, 2019. My name is Tom Martin, and Dick, thank you very much.
Well, thank you for the interview.